There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
I'm Helen Farmer. You are listening to DubaiEye 103.8. It's your dose of therapy. And please do remember that this is your chance to have any questions or concerns dealt with, acknowledged, hopefully answered as to the best of our abilities here live in the studio. And this week we're taking an in-depth look at men's mental health. We're talking about some big issues over the course of the next 2 hours, and I'm joined by Dr. Thoraya, clinical psychologist and co-owner of the Human Relations Institute and Clinic, to guide us through this topic and, most importantly, answer your questions and address those concerns. Good afternoon, Dr. Thoraya.
Good afternoon, Helen.
You're looking very glowy and happy this afternoon.
I'm actually happy to be here. It's been a while, so
I know,
I've missed being on the show.
Your face. No, it's lovely to have you. And I know this is a topic that you're really, really passionate about.
Yes.
And as Tom said earlier, we're talking about men's mental health more and more at the moment, and for very good reason. The stats are actually really quite frightening. There was a survey done by the Men's Health Forum in 2016 that said 9% of men describe themselves as severely or extremely stressed. 34% agreed or strongly agreed that they were feeling constantly under pressure. And 36% would be embarrassed or ashamed to take time off work from mental health concerns such as anxiety or depression, compared to just 13% for a physical injury. And I still think we're battling a stigma. You're obviously having people coming into your clinic who are ready to talk about their problems, but there are a huge number of people who aren't at that stage yet.
Absolutely. And, you know, even the men that I see that come in and want to talk about their difficulties, they struggle so much with the idea of really opening up and sharing, because for such a long period of time in their lives, they haven't really been given the opportunity nor the freedom to truly open up without being judged or mocked or made fun of. And so, you know, going through the stigma is not just for women, but it's also for men. Actually, it's even more for men when it comes to mental health. And when you said that I'm very passionate about this topic, I really am, because for me, spreading awareness about men's mental health goes so much further and should go so much further than it is where it is right now, because men suffer silently. They really do so much more than women ever do, because women sort of have been given the social okay that, you know, it's okay for you to talk about your feelings. It's okay for you to open up. It's okay for you to vent. Whereas men, it's like, no, you have to be tough and strong and hold it in and swallow it up and suck it up, you know? And so men suffer so much more than women do silently.
And that could be a real cultural thing as well. Speaking as a Brit, you know, it's that stiff upper lip that, you know, must be the strong one to support my wife, both, you know, financially perhaps, but more importantly, I'm the one that's supposed to be strong for her. And the implications of that strength or perceived strength when there's a lot more going on under the surface can be hugely damaging. And now, I don't want to make sweeping generalizations, but why is it, do you think, that so many men find it hard to share those feelings?
Well, if you really go back to the way we're raised as kids, you know, men are usually raised to have that. And I know you said it's cultural, but really when you look at the world the way that it is, across all cultures, men are socialized to believe that they must be strong, that they're supposed to be the head of the family, that sort of like caveman kind of being. So they have to, you know, like I said, suck it up. They, you know, boys don't cry, you know, boys don't share how they feel. They like dust themselves off and they keep moving forward. So that socialization that boys have as children also turns into a socialization that their friendship groups start to have as well. So not only do you get it from parents, but you also get it from the friend group as they get older.
Absolutely. I think it's even the kind of the most, you know, gender equal parents, and, you know, kind of a very 2018 phrase about gender equality and even gender neutral. It's very, very hard to stop these little words or phrases creeping into parenting. As you say, kind of boys don't cry, or beautiful girl, or, you know, good lads, you know, that emphasis on the sport. And boys can be very much harmed by these gender stereotypes just as much as young girls can. And I think it's really interesting how you pointed out that men often just aren't given the tools about how to discuss these things. What about showing vulnerability?
Well, it's very difficult for men because ultimately the basis of the definition of a man has been socialized to believe that, you know, you have to be strong and hold it together and not be vulnerable. So it's really almost like you're removing a part of their identity when you say that, you know, when they start opening up, when they start to feel vulnerable, when they start to cry. So they almost feel as if their manhood is being stripped away from them. And that's actually the fault of the socialization of how we treat men rather than it is the reality of the situation, because ultimately men are like women. We're all human, which means we all go through emotions, and we go through sadness as much as happiness, as much as anger, as much as irritation and frustration and joy. And so it's natural for men to feel these things, but we don't necessarily give them the opportunity nor the tools to learn how to cope with those kind of emotions.
And what impact could that then have on men's mental health to have all of those feelings kept inside and not expressed in a healthy way?
Well, you know, unfortunately, what we find is that there's an increase in mental health disorders with men more than women. But unfortunately, we don't recognize it in men as much as we do with women. You know, there's even a statistic. I've been trying to find it for quite some time now, but I can't seem to locate it. But there's an actual statistic on how psychiatrists will prescribe antidepressants more for women than they do for men, even though they show the same symptomology.
We were literally talking about this yesterday with Dr. Heather Reed, talking about female menopause and the male menopause, and patients, male and female, going to the same doctor, presenting the same symptoms, and men being told, you should be having some more protein, you should be working out, and the women being prescribed antidepressants, which is pretty disturbing, actually.
Absolutely, and it's very minimizing and invalidating for men when they come in with depressive symptoms and they're told, oh, you're just too stressed out. You have to have like a proper work-life balance. Whereas a woman goes in with the same exact symptomology and they're given antidepressants, they're more cared for, they're looked after, they're considered, they're validated. So for men, it's just an extra, you know, additive factor of, we don't really matter that much. Our feelings don't matter that much.
Yeah, it's really, really reductive, isn't it? Now, I came across this word time and time again when looking into this issue. What is it alexithymia? So about basically not being able to express those feelings. So it's almost like a condition in some ways, I suppose, of being physically unable to open up about those feelings.
And also not recognizing those feelings as well. I mean, really, when you think of, you know, when you're a child as a female, you're told, like, how are you feeling? What's going on? You know, you're almost encouraged to really introspect and to become more insightful and mindful of your own feelings. Whereas with men, as children, they're not really asked as often, how are you feeling? If anything, it's like, what did you do today? Did you win the sport? Did you do, you know, how are your grades? So it's more action-based rather than feeling-based. So they don't have the know-how to express those kinds of feelings.
And can men sometimes convert one feeling into another that they might recognize? So hurt or sadness into anger that is a more of a tangible feeling for them?
Absolutely. I mean, ultimately, you know, psychologists will recognize that anger is not really a primary emotion. It's what we call a secondary emotion, which is really the reaction to a primary emotion. And the primary emotion is pain, or it's hurt, or sadness. And what men will do, they show different in terms of depression, whereas women will get sad, they might cry, they might become isolated. Men actually become more angry, more aggressive. They might also isolate, but they'll be more violently aggressive, and not necessarily physically, but either towards others in terms of like lashing out, or even more towards themselves. Well, they'll say things like, you know, I'm so stupid, I'm unworthy, I'm incompetent, I'm not good enough, those kind of things. So either that becomes outward, or it will turn, a lot stronger inward as well.
What about physical manifestations of emotions?
Absolutely. So things like heart racing, high blood pressure, they might go through stomach, gastro difficulties, constipation, diarrhea, headaches, back pain. So it can manifest.
A lot of physical symptoms.
Absolutely. We call them psychosomatic symptoms because of that, because they're actually based on psychological difficulties that are manifesting themselves into physiological symptoms.
Now, thankfully, men's mental health is being talked about more and more, both in the media, on people's personal blogs, but also by celebrities as well. And Heads Together is a charity that was set up by the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge and Prince Harry to basically change the conversation around mental health. And he spoke to a British journalist called Bryony Gordon. And this is him talking about how to open up that conversation when it comes to sharing your worries.
You know what? I've spent most of my life saying I'm fine. And I've used exactly the conversation we've just had there as an example to so many other people, with people saying, how are you? How are you? I'm fine. And it was a case of just saying fine is so much better than having to go into the details.
Yeah.
Because as soon as you say, oh, you know, so, then there's another question that follows that. And then another question, another question. And most of us aren't up for going that deep.
Yeah.
So today I'm okay. I'm a little bit nervous. A little bit tight in the chest, but otherwise fine.
Don't be nervous.
No, it's understandable.
You guys can put your name to any kind of charitable cause. But why did mental health kind of stand out for you?
A combination of reasons, really. One was the fact that because of all the charity work that William, Catherine and I have been doing, everywhere we go, there's a conversation that happens with somebody that we've spoken to that links it into a mental health conversation of sorts. And all of us put our heads together, funnily enough, and thought, you know what? What would be really good is if we can somehow capture the interest of the whole of the UK mm-hmm. and make sure that we can somehow change the conversation and change the tide on mental health specifically, because it's linked into so many different things. Mm. And while all of this was happening, we kept meeting people that were struggling. People were talking about it. It was written about in the newspapers. The experience that I've had is that once you start talking about it, you suddenly realize that actually you're part of quite a big club.
Yeah, there's a real community.
Yeah, exactly. It's a real community, and everybody's gagging to talk about it. And I don't know whether it's being British and being sort of, you know, this stiff upper lip, or whether it's just us not being in touch with our emotions, or not being cool to talk about it, or being a weakness, all this sort of stuff. After whatever it has been, specifically the last 5-6 years of talking with the lads that have left the military and post-traumatic stress specifically, or, you know, depression, anxiety, panic attacks and alcoholism, all of that stuff, having those conversations with those guys, it became blindingly obvious to me that even if it was a small problem from your youth, something, Afghanistan in a lot of these cases, was the trigger mm-hmm. for all of these issues to therefore, you know, to come forward. So it just became obvious to us that no matter who you are, a conversation has to be the beginning, because otherwise, how are you ever going to know who to see, where to go mm-hmm. and how to solve it?
That was Prince Harry talking to British journalist Bryony Gordon about his own mental health issues and that of men across the UK and indeed across the world. When we come back, Dr. Thrya is going to be answering some of your questions. A message here saying, this won't be a very popular statement, we are vulnerable. We don't have any less emotions to express. We are afraid. We do feel beaten by life at times. There's just less drama in it all. So lots of messages coming in here asking for Dr. Thrya's help. And we do have a call, I believe. Good afternoon, Alex.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thank you. I've got Dr. Thrya here on the line as well. How can we help you this afternoon?
Actually, I sent a message. I'm a male in my 40s, and I have this periodic depression. Like, I go through those for no reason, you know, like sometimes I'm thinking about it and there's no reason about it at all, but it just like come and attack once in a while. So I've seen doctor a couple of times about it, and then they just like, well, it's just like probably because of work or some stress you get from the work or life or whatever, and just like they mostly suggest workout, regular exercise or some stuff like that. But I couldn't, you know, I do regular exercise and I, you know, like I'm not smoking or I'm not, you know, any other habits. But I couldn't get over this one. And actually these periods are getting more and more closer to each other and getting more and more depressing. And I had a background of IBS, so this IBS is getting, you know, worse and worse. So whenever this depression comes, the period finishes with the IBS starting, so that I have to go through it for a week or two until the medication kicks in and that one finished. So I was thinking, should I go to like a professional psychologist and get more help on that, or this is something that's very regular, that all the men getting, like ladies, they're getting their regular period and men get it the same way.
Well, you know, thank you, first of all, Alex, for talking to us about this. But what I would suggest is that maybe it would be good to talk to a professional first to see. Now, usually, yes, IBS is very comorbid with depression. But realistically, depression is not something that needs to come from somewhere. Depression can be something that's also genetic, also biological. So there could be something more that's happening, especially if you're living a very stressful life, either at work or at home. So your IBS symptoms will act up, which will then cause more depression, and then depression will cause more of the IBS. So it is better for you to speak to a professional in terms of looking at whether or not, first of all, medication for the depression might be necessary. And if not, what else could you do from a non-medical perspective to maybe change your life in certain ways? Not necessarily just exercising, but also maybe creating a proper work-life balance. Yeah, and therapy, work-life balance, you know, being able to talk about things, reducing the amount of stress in your life. So these kind of things will help, but I think it might be good for you to consult a professional first.
Alex, can I just ask, when you talk about the depressive episodes, how do they manifest? How do you feel, and how do you spend your time during those episodes?
Well, when this depression starts, I just don't want to do anything. And then sometimes it depends on the level. Sometimes it goes to like a crying couple of hours a day for no reason. You know, just like I could have watched something very basic, like my favorite TV program, and I could cry like half an hour right after that. And even sometimes I don't even have a feeling of getting up in the morning to go to work or even go to the gym. The most stuff that I enjoy, I don't want to do it, or even answer my calls from my friends or something like that.
And do you have someone you can talk to at the moment in your life, some friends or a partner or family that you're able to express how you're feeling to?
Well, yes and no. Actually, coming a background of the medical parents and stuff, but I try to speak with them, but they don't want, you know, even most of the medical parents probably don't want to accept that the kids have something. So friends, yes, I do sometimes, but I still think that even speaking with friends on too detail, because it's not their concern that much, you know, I can't go too much of details with them, and I'm not sure even if I get the suggestion or the advice would be the correct thing to do. You know, maybe I'm getting something that could elevate the problem.
Dr. Thoreau, can I just ask, if Alex is feeling a bit reluctant or intimidated about going to see a mental health professional, what could he expect when he goes through the door and meets somebody such as yourself?
Well, usually, you know, the first session is usually the intake session. That's where we're gathering as much information as we can. It's where you're also connecting to your therapist as well. And sometimes some individuals feel more comfortable speaking to the same sex gender, or some of them prefer speaking to an opposite sex gender. So it's really more about who you're, not just who you're talking to, but also the therapist is expected to really provide a safe and non-judgmental atmosphere for the individual to feel comfortable enough to discuss everything that they're going through.
Okay, Alex, I really hope that helps. And it sounds like you're on the right path by certainly acknowledging how you're feeling and coming on the show to talk about that. So we really, really appreciate that.
I appreciate your call, guys.
And wishing you all the best for the future. Messages are coming in, and when we come back, we'll be answering them. Take care. We've had a message here saying, I would never want to be a man. At least I have friends who will listen to my problems. Most men don't have friends for that. I think that's a really interesting point, actually, Dr. Thoreau, that I think as women, we are socially conditioned. We're much more comfortable going out with friends for coffee and saying to someone, hi, how are you? And you, most of the time, can say, this has happened, can we talk about this?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And for men, it's not that simple. I mean, it's not that men don't talk to each other, but their conversations are a lot shorter and a lot less in depth. And that can be helpful. But just like Alex had mentioned a little bit before, you know, even with his parents, he doesn't feel like he can talk to them. And that's the reality for a lot of men, is that they don't feel like they can talk to anybody, because either it's the wife that they don't want to talk to because they feel like they'll burden her, or they'll make her feel very unsafe or insecure. So they don't want to do that, or they don't want to talk to a friend because they don't want the friend to worry about them, or maybe even make fun of them or ridicule them, or family members because they might not understand. So men tend to have less of an emotional support as women do, and feel less comfortable opening up to women as women feel comfortable. I mean, to men as women feel comfortable opening up to women.
Now, just to go back to that anonymous message there about sexual abuse and harassment, I understand you've got some information that might be quite useful.
Yeah, actually, in the UK, there's statistics that approximately 12,000 men per year are sexually assaulted. And usually the average age for, and of those, of that number, about 16% of them have been assaulted before the age of 18. And the average age is actually 4 years old. And so this is, these are statistics that people don't usually think of or even consider or fathom when they think about sexual assault, because usually we automatically go to women, but actually there are so many cases of sexual assault amongst men, and these are not men who are incarcerated. These are men that are free, that are walking around, as well as even domestic abuse. And that's another one that a lot of people tend to, you know, scoff off, like, it's nothing, come on.
No, it's, I think that it's a presumption of, oh, that's a woman's problem. But actually the kind of the latest statistics saying around 40% of domestic abuse victims are male.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure that's probably underreported, because men might be more reluctant to step forward and say, this is the situation under our roof, and this is the position, situation I found myself in with my wife or partner, and not want to, as you say, to open themselves up to, you know, potential ridicule or investigation that would make them feel threatened in some way.
Of course. I mean, consider like the countries like the UK, the US, Canada, a lot of countries in Europe, you know, they're opening up to the idea of mental health and men's mental health, but there's still so much stigma attached to it. And still there's underreports of sexual and physical assault on men. Now, imagine taking that and going to more male-dominated cultures where that wouldn't even possibly be reported. So the statistics that come out all over the world, I am sure, are far less than what is actually going on. Because, you know, the statistics, for instance, on depression are 1 in 5 individuals are depressed. Imagine.
That's amazing.
Or anxiety, 1 in 4. And that, this is the world population. This is, these are the statistics for the world population. 1 in 5 are depressed and 1 in 4 are anxious. Now, when you look at the statistics for men, they'll say things like 300,000, you know, individuals are, 300,000 men worldwide are depressed. You got to be kidding me. There's 8 billion people on this planet, right? And 4 billion of them have to be men at least, plus or minus. So there should really be at least 20% of those 4 billion that are depressed, and that's not 300,000. So we have so much less information about men's mental health, which is why we call it the silent crisis for men, because they are suffering in silence a lot more than women are.
And the very serious implications of that are suicide rates being increasing year on year. Statistics are showing around 84 men per week in the UK are taking their own lives. That's 84 per week. A message here that's come in saying, how can I help my husband? He hates his job but fears losing it and not finding another. I don't work and look after our 4 children. His personality has changed since we met. We don't have fun anymore, and I worry that he's depressed. All he does is complain about work and then go out with his friends.
Well, you know, that's one of the most difficult things for men as well when it comes to work, and when they're the sole breadwinner at home, because they know that they can't let go of the job that they have. But more often than not, support coming from a wife is very important in terms of letting them feel that no matter what, things will be okay. And helping them recognize that their health, their family life is far more important than them being, you know, miserable at work, and that they'll find another job, and that money is not the main concern. And it's okay if they're not making as much money, and it's okay if they're not, you know, it's about really supporting.
It's complicated here, though, isn't it? Because if you haven't got a job, then you don't have a residency visa. So it's a lot more kind of tied up in life here in terms of work. So I do understand that fear of redundancy or the fear of debt, for feeling a bit more precarious in this part of the world. So as a wife, she just needs to be there for him as much as possible.
Well, yeah, but also, you know, the reality that a lot of people forget is that this is not the only city in the world that people can find a job. And I know that the people love Dubai, and Dubai provides so many places, so many things and opportunities for people. But if a person's health is being affected and they're, you know, like she said, his personality is changing, he's not going out anymore, so he's not being able to handle that level of stress in his job. If he can't find another job here, you can find it somewhere else. But his mental health is so much more important than all of that. And yes, it's going to be a little bit difficult and the transition is going to be complicated, but his mental health is just as important. And this is the same for, like, when we consider women, you know, after they give birth, you know, their mental health is super important. So we can't just negate that just because they gave birth. So we have to give, you know, them the opportunity and the support to get the help that they need, the same way we need to do for men.
It sounds like she's suffering as well. You know, it must be upsetting for, you know, being looking after four children, which is no mean feat, your husband to come home and then you're getting a barrage of negativity, really, because he's not happy in his own situation. So it sounds like perhaps she could do with some support as well.
Of course.
Dr. Rai, we have got a call, anonymous listener. Hi, good afternoon. How can we help?
Hello, good afternoon.
Hi. Can you share your experience? Can we help?
Yes, it's actually regarding my partner.
Okay, and what's his problem, or what symptoms is he manifesting?
See, I'm not an expert, and I don't know why my partner has got these you know, extremes in his mood. So he can go from one extreme to another in matter of hours, or things could be really, really going well, and then suddenly he could become depressive, aggressive, the mood would change, he would start seeing things in a very pessimistic way, and that has affected us negatively. It has affected our relationship negatively, because I've never felt like we could build on the positive experiences that we have together. That we'll always have to like the go back and regress and sort of, you know, go back and revisit issues that we probably have faced in the past, and those mood swings are so extreme that I'm wondering whether that could be something related to a bipolar disease. And of course, when you just mentioned something about how guys, when they hang out together, they really don't confess about their feelings and their mental health to each other. And so when he's around with his friends, and of course he acts and sounds happy and normal, so it would be really, really difficult for me to seek help through his friends, because they that wouldn't register. It would be like, oh, but he was just having a fun time, you know, hang out with the boys. So it's one of the things which I'm struggling with, and I don't know how to convince him that he should probably seek professional help.
Okay, Dr. Thryer, any advice there on perhaps unpicking what he might be suffering from, and how this lady can help him?
Well, you know, usually the misconception of bipolarity is that, you know, that you go through mood swings. You're happy one second, you're sad another second. That's actually not what bipolarity is. And like I had mentioned before, men usually will express their depression and their sadness in anger and in aggression. So if that's what you're seeing recently or more, and he's suffering from other symptoms, like, you know, he's not sleeping as much, or he's sleeping more, he's not eating as much, or he's eating more, so changes in his energy levels, his concentration, he's feeling a lot more helpless, guilty, you know. So if there are an array of symptoms that you're seeing more consistent, then it definitely sounds a lot more like depression, and it might be helpful for you maybe not to approach him as you need to get help, but maybe let's go get some help together, because we're not doing so well. So instead of it being more offensive, it might be better for you to tackle it as, you know, something's going on in our relationship. Let's see if we can fix whatever it is that's happening between us, rather than just pointing the fingers and saying, you know, this is more a you issue than it is an us issue.
May I ask a question?
Of course.
Well, when you say suggest that we go together as a couple because things are not going well. Do you think a couple counselor would be able to help my partner overcome that depression? I mean, I'm not sure about that. The expertise level of a couples counselor in tackling issues like that.
So you'd be concerned that a couples counselor would be looking more at the marriage issue rather than the depression issue?
So who should I contact in this case?
Well, actually, the couples counselors are just as qualified to be able to identify depression or any other kind of mental health disorder in individuals. So they will be able to identify that, even if you're working on couples therapy. And ultimately, sometimes, even if the depression itself is there, it can be alleviated when or minimized when the relationship difficulties are minimizing and being worked on as well. So not all depression needs to be medicated and needs to be worked on individually. Sometimes within couples therapy, the depression can actually alleviate and minimize.
Okay, I really hope that helps. And wishing you and your partner all of the best. If you'd like to come on and have a chat, get some expert advice from Dr. Thryer, please do get in touch. You can give us a call, 04423 1010. You can download the new Dubai Eye Messenger app so you can contact us for free. Or you can message us on 4001. We're talking about men's mental health this afternoon on the couch. Message here that's come in saying, as men, nowadays we prefer to live alone instead of having a wife and family because of the increasing of women and children's rights and ignoring the man's minimal rights. And that is affecting men's mental health. Dr. Thryer, any comments on that?
I wouldn't say the focus is only on women and children's rights, but I would say that they're absolutely correct, that we forget that men suffer just as much as women and children do, and we're not giving them the proper guidance and support that they need and deserve. And I definitely agree with that, but I don't think it's because we're giving more rights to women and children. It's just we're giving more rights to women and children because we are socialized to believe that they're more vulnerable, and we're forgetting how vulnerable men can be as well.
And I think it's important to realize it's not a zero-sum game. Just because women and children are getting rights doesn't take rights away from men. A message from Anonymous saying, hi, I want to share my past experience with my mother-in-law. She's a tongue-slippery kind of person. She used to say so many harsh words to me directly and indirectly. I've become so depressed when I think about it. Now I'm separated and have been in the UA for 2 years. My husband is very supportive, but the majority of time I spent with my mother-in-law, some harsh words are irritating and it still hurts me a lot. Dr. Thryer, I think we've talked about the in-law relationship this week, actually, and what a tricky one that is to navigate. So we have got the caller back on, and when we come back, we'll address that issue of the mother-in-law. Hi, good afternoon. Sorry we lost you there.
Oh, it's all right, no worries.
How can we help?
I have a question for Dr. Thryer.
Of course,
so,
tell us.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. How are you, more to the point?
I'm good, thank you. So my question is basically, I've been with my partner now for 5 years, and after we got married and moved in together, he's not there anymore. You get what I mean? He's always on his computer. As soon as he gets home from work, he's just on his computer, doesn't pay attention to me, doesn't say hi, doesn't talk, nothing. And then the whole time I'm cooking, I'm cleaning, I'm doing everything in the house, but he doesn't help at all. And when I ask him, do you want to spend time together? He's like, no, I'm busy, or I don't want to, or whatever like that.
So you're not communicating and you're not feeling like a priority anymore?
At all, no.
Has there been a shift in the type of relationship that you've had over the past 5 years, or has this always been the case since the beginning?
It's kind of been like this, but it got worse since we moved in together. I'm more like his mom or his maid than his partner.
Okay, that must actually be very difficult for you. This is a tough question, but was this a marriage, an arranged marriage or a love marriage?
No, firm love.
Okay. And so you said that in the beginning it was a little bit like this, but it got a little bit worse as time went along. Had anything changed in your relationship? Is there a baby? either?
No, but we're living together now.
Okay, so, well, you know, one of the things that I usually promote more than anything is communication between couples. And sometimes when men are not talking and they're on their computer or they're doing something else, that's actually a very loud form of communication from them, which is, you know, I'm sort of staying away from you. I'm not listening to you. I'm rejecting you at this moment. And that can be very painful for the other spouse, obviously.
Yes.
And so, do you have any family or friends that that know him well that can help you intervene if you've already tried talking to him?
I don't think so. Maybe, like, no, not really.
Okay. So, are you close with your in-laws in terms of, or his family members? Because usually what happens in situations where you try to talk to your spouse and they're not very big on talking back with you, either approaching it in a different way, either from somebody else or somebody that they're close to, or even maybe writing an email or writing something down, you know, trying it in a different way might be helpful. Not because... You know, not because it might work, but it's just because sometimes people have difficulty processing their feelings and processing what they're going through. And when you approach them face to face, they might feel very intimidated and shut down. So usually when you give them some time or you change your strategy, it might give them a little bit more of an opportunity to gather their words, gather their thoughts, and then come back with to you with proper information.
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea. Because when I try to talk, he just gets angry. So I think it's better to do it like, here's my thoughts and process and then come back.
Mm-hmm.
Someone's just messaged in saying, dear current caller, I'm in the same situation. Wait till you have kids. So I do think helpful to deal with this as soon as possible, really. And as Dr. Thrice says, taking a different approach, because he might come home and feel like, okay, she's going to start nagging me about talking again and he's going to be defensive. You're craving that attention and that communication. So taking that different approach could be really beneficial.
And also, it's important to recognize maybe the family structure of his family. So, for instance, how does his father deal with his mom in terms of, do they communicate? And because sometimes individuals are not taught to communicate, whether it's male or female. And, you know, looking at how he responds to you might be a sort of like a pattern of how his parents respond to each other or how his parents have responded to him. So actually teaching him how to communicate might be also helpful.
And also,
yeah, that's actually true.
Also, if you've just, you know, changed when you moved in together, if he's used to seeing his mother as someone who's there to cook for him and clean for him and tidy up after his bodily functions, he's, you know, transferring that to you as his carer. And it sounds like the romance has gone a little bit, and that sense of care and attention that you want and need has gone as well. So communicating that to him, that you as a person need that, you know, and repositioning yourself, not just his, you know, as you said, his maid.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, I really hope that helps. Thank you so much for
great.
Sharing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Let's go back to this question about the mother-in-law, Dr. Thryer, whose harsh words have caused some depression in the message that we got, saying, I want to share my past experience with my mother-in-law. She said so many harsh words to me directly and indirectly. I've become depressed when I think about it. I'm now separated. Any insights there on navigating that relationship?
Well, you know, the term monster-in-law didn't come from nowhere. I mean, ultimately, you know, it's very difficult to navigate the relationship between a mother-in-law and the wife, because there's a lot of not just intimidation, but there's a lot of, you know, discomfort in the fact that this person has now replaced me. And even that is not may not be a very direct thought. It's a very indirect and subconscious sort of feeling.
Yeah, and it's not a defined relationship. It's not like, you know, we are married now. It's we're married and there's this person, and how do we interact, and how much do I listen to her, how much do you listen to her? And it's very confusing.
It is. And really, the reality of the situation is focusing more on your relationship with your husband and not allowing third parties to affect that relationship, because it's very easy to fall into the trap of allowing the mother-in-law's harsh words to be because you can't say anything back to her, so you take it out on your husband. So you need to be very careful to separate what the mother-in-law is saying to you versus what your husband is saying or doing with you. And separating the two, because ultimately it can ruin the relationship that you have with your husband, but really it's not his position to really... he can't stop his mother, because ultimately his mother is his mother. She's going to do and say as she feels, and sometimes even not when he's around. So he might not know or see what's going on. It's good to ask him for support if he is around, to ask him to sort of stand up for you, to maybe set some boundaries. It's good for you to set some boundaries respectfully as well. But if the mother continues to behave harshly and she continues to be mean, I would suggest to just, you know, distance yourself slowly and ask your husband to be supportive of that fact.
And it sounds like she's giving her mother-in-law a lot of power there to allow what she says to impact her so much. And maybe worth asking, why do you care so much about what she thinks of you? And try and, you know, kind of take wind out of her sails, or just don't let it affect you as much, or question why it does.
Right. And, you know, some cultures are a lot more it's a lot more difficult for them to do that, because they live with their in-laws as well. So I can appreciate that your situation might be a little bit complicated in that sense. But what I would suggest is strengthen the relationship between you and your husband. Ask him to support you, and as well maybe discuss of a plan of how to maybe minimize the interaction, so that, you know, you can't change the mother-in-law. She's going to throw out harsh words. She's going to do it anyways. But to minimize that interaction with the support of your husband, so that things don't get sticky between you and your husband.
Okay. I'm joined this afternoon by Dr. Thryer, who's here to address mental health issues, but specifically men's mental health issues. So if you've got any questions or concerns, please do get in touch. Lots of questions coming in. I'll be getting to them after this. We do have a call. This is Miriam. Hi, Miriam. How can we help this afternoon? I understand you're calling on behalf of a friend.
Yes. So my friend comes from a bicultural family, so part Arab, part Western. And my friend grew up, is a male, and grew up for a very long time without his father around. So the father has sort of reappeared, and in the past few years has been making a lot of financial demands on my friend. And initially my friend was very happy to help, but the demands have just grown increasingly with time and are becoming very difficult to comply with. So he's made a request with his father to, you know, slow down on the demands, or just give him some time, and the father is now giving him the silent treatment. And it's leaving a bad taste in his mouth. He gets the feeling that if he does not comply, then he is not loved.
Okay. Thanks, Mariam, for calling in. You know, it sounds like your friend's going through something quite toxic, to be quite honest, because, you know, the fact that his father hasn't been around for a very long time and then came back into his life in a very transactional way, this is where, you know, he's your friend starting to feel like his father's love is conditional. If he gives him financial help, then his father will love him and talk to him. And if he doesn't, he's obviously getting the silent treatment from him.
Exactly.
But it's important to maybe speak to your friend and discuss the idea of boundaries and really setting boundaries with his father. So the idea that his father is going to get mad at him if he puts, you know, boundaries to the financial demands that he has, it's something that he's going to have to go through and accept that it's okay that his father gets mad at him. He has sort of, you know, it's okay for him to feel how he wants to feel, but he doesn't have to change the way he behaves just because his father feels that way. Because ultimately it is important for your friend to take care of himself first. Not from a very selfish manner, but ultimately we can't help others if we can't help ourselves first. So it's important that your friend take care of himself financially, and whatever he can support, he will if he wants to, but not feel that sense of pressure that if I don't, then my father won't care for me, because that in and of itself is extremely toxic in the type of relationship between father and son.
Yeah, well, my friend is currently living with his father, not because, mainly because it's a cultural thing, and mainly because he felt that his father wanted him around. And I think that that's also adding to the pressure of, because he's almost 30, so, you know, it's kind of like that sort of teenage parent relationship that he never had, and now it's sort of locking himself up in the room all the time, and the father feeling like, oh, you don't want to spend time with the family. It's very sort of old school issues that they never really had when he was younger. And to add to that, there's a lot of not just the cultural issues, but also religious guilt, where in their religion, there is a misconception, or everyone loves to understand religion in their own way. So from the father's perspective, it's you must obey your parent no matter what, and if you make me unhappy, you're going to hell. But from the son's perspective, it's, look, I am trying to help, but there's only so much that I can do. And I think there's also that guilt as well. There's a lot of layers to it.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like there's a lot of layers to it. And to be quite honest, you know, this is where your friend needs to recognize whether or not this relationship is going to help him move forward in life or not. And I understand the cultural implication of that. But the reality is that he has to take care of himself as well. Even if it's not first, it's as well. And at this moment, he's suffering being at the house with his father, because not just financially, but he's also suffering emotionally and psychologically. And like you said, he might be trying to make up for lost times, but essentially, this is not that kind of a situation. This is not lost times. If anything, this is a very transactional sort of relationship that the father is demanding on the child. So if the child doesn't share the same thoughts and feelings as the father in any way, then it's important for him to recognize that this is who his father is, and that he can love and respect him and care for him, but from his own perspective
as
well.
On his own terms.
Yes,
yeah.
On his own terms. Like, he doesn't have to give up his father. He doesn't have to cut ties with his father, but he can do it in a way that he's still taking care of himself as well.
Really okay,
hope
so
that
just
helps.
Working on that balance. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you so much for coming on asking those questions, Miriam. Now, I want to stay on the topic of fathers, actually. Robert Webb is an English comedian, an actor and writer who's written a memoir called How Not to Be a Boy, and it explores masculinity and gender, and it's based on his own childhood. He actually waited until both his father and his stepfather had passed away before writing this book. Let's have a listen to him talking about what he feels it is to be a boy.
Hello, my name is Robert Webb, and I've written How Not to Be a Boy, which is themed around masculinity and how boys are supposed to be boys and how that gender stuff affects some of us when we attempt to grow up. Because I think gender is made up, the book is in two acts, acting like a boy and acting like a man. I'll just do act one. So, chapter one, Boys Can't Get Enough of Dad. I got the strong impression that I was supposed to prefer the company of my dad to my mum, which was tricky because he was a bit of a scary, shouty, boozy handful with a flexible attitude to monogamy, and that's why my mum divorced him when I was 5. I knew it was shameful to be a mummy's boy, but that's exactly what I was. Boys aren't shy. I was almost completely mute at this point, but I understood that boys were supposed to be noisy and cheeky and boisterous. I had an imaginary gang of friends called the Guy Boys, and we used to go around fighting crime. I didn't want to play with real boys because they scared me. Boys love sport. I was rubbish at all sports. I say in the book that communal showering is a fresh hell that concludes each game's lesson. Boys are never teacher's pet. Obviously, boys don't have any common sense, boys can't sit still, boys would rather be climbing a tree than reading a book, anything to avoid being called a girly swat. Boys don't cry. By this time I'm 17, and I'm sorry to tell you that my mum died of cancer that year. I was lucky enough to have friends and family saying, look, if you need to talk, then just talk, I'm here. And I was grateful for the kindness, but I experienced it as pressure. Because if I learned anything from all this stuff, it was that boys don't cry. Boys don't express unwanted emotions. You shrug it off, you bottle it up. If it comes out at all, it comes out as anger. And that's what happened when I stopped being bad at acting like a boy, and I started being even worse at acting like a man. How much worse, you can find out in the book.
So
Thanks for listening.
That was Robert Webb, an English actor and writer, talking about his book, How Not to Be a Boy. Now, we know there's a lot of kind of female empowerment and about, you know, girl power, but boys can face really harmful stereotypes too. So if you're parenting a boy, how can we support them, Dr. Thrower?
You know, one of the things that he mentioned was this idea of, and I love how he phrased it, was that this impression of gender appropriate development and the idea that boys have to do certain things and then that turns from boys to men and they have that mindset. There are different ways that parents can tackle this. So, for instance, removing all those stereotypical boys will be boys kind of, you know, mindset. So boys don't have to play sports. If they want to read a book, they can read a book. There's nothing wrong with reading a book. Actually, I prefer that people read books to just playing sports and that's it. Also, it's okay if boys want to play with dolls, and it's okay if boys want to wear pink, and it's okay if boys, you know, so, and it's okay for boys to cry, it's okay for them to show emotions, it's okay for them to be the teacher's pet, it's okay for them to prefer the mom, it's okay for them to spend more time with other girls as well as other guys. You know, it's okay for the boy to do whatever it is that they want to do. The same way we promote that for girls now, especially now more than any other time in the world, like we promote this empowerment of women to do whatever it is that they want. We should do the same for men, because there's a lot, even with jobs, you know, when men become nurses, all of a sudden they're looked at like, what's wrong with you? Why didn't you become a doctor? Kind of a thing. Or if men decide that they want to become teachers, what, you couldn't hack it as a professor, you know, like things like that. We're just so harsh when it comes to boys and when it comes to men, and we expect them to do these, you know, quote unquote manly things. I actually don't even know what that means, because ultimately it's not really a manly thing, it's more like a robotic thing. We're expecting men to be robots. And here's my sort of rant and spiel when it comes
to Dr. Thrower.
I think there are a lot of women that are going to attack me on this, but I have a massive issue when it comes to women and how they treat men, because, you know, women want that soft spoken sort of like emotionally understanding, empathetic man, but not too much, because then if he is, he's more of a wuss and he's not manly enough for me. I mean, when men say that women are complicated, they are correct, because we are never happy with anything that we get. You know, if he's super sweet and kind and empathetic, it's like, you know, he's not manly enough for me. And if he's too much macho and manly, which is another thing that we like, it's like, well, you know, he's not sensitive enough. I mean, like, come on, give them something they can work with. Absolutely. Like, give them something that they can work with so that they can learn how to be themselves, not for you, for themselves. We are promoting women to do things for themselves. We promote women to love themselves. We need to do that for men as well. They need to love themselves no matter who they are, what they like, what they do. And women need to learn to support that as well. And when the funny thing is that women are always like, well, we support our friends. No, we don't. We don't. Let's be honest. We support them to their face, and then behind their backs, we're like, like all these negative things. And we do the same for men, you know, like we support them to their face and then behind their back, like, well, you know, he should have done this or he should have done that. The reality is that we need to support each other no matter what, because ultimately the true mental health happiness, and not in that like cheery, like smiley all the time, no, but that mental health stability and mental health satisfaction only comes when you are truly satisfied with who you are as an individual for yourself.
Love it. I'm going to leave it there. When we come back, we're going to be talking about sleep. We're talking about boarding school syndrome, and we've got a really interesting clip from Zoe Ball. Stay with us. We're just teasing Dr. Thrower because somebody on our tech team said she looks a bit like Jennifer Lawrence, and we all agree, and she's now mortified.
I'm only mortified because she looks like me, because I'm much older than she is.
Okay, Jennifer Lawrence looks like Dr. Thrower. We'll reposition it. We'll put a photo up later and you guys can see what I mean. Now, we are talking about men's mental health this afternoon. It's On the Couch. Dr. Thrower is here to support you, to offer you some free advice. This is your chance to get in touch with any questions, any concerns that we can address. A question here on the topic of sleep. Dr. Thrower saying, I haven't been able to sleep for the past 5 months. I keep waking up several times at night and sometimes can't sleep at all, like last night. Where should I go? FYI, I enjoy my job and have no financial or relationship issues.
Well, the first thing I would suggest is to go see a sleep doctor, because they are great at doing sleep tests. And what they check for is what cycle in the what they call the sleep cycle are you focused on. So if a person is not able to sleep properly, then they're usually in the awake state, which is stage one, and they're not able to move into stage two, stage three, or REM sleep. So it's important to get a sleep test to find out what's happening and see the professional for it. So a sleep doctor would be great. There is a great one at the MediClinic City Hospital in DHCC.
Can you suddenly just stop sleeping?
I mean, it's very rare to just suddenly stop sleeping. Usually insomnia will come out from a trigger, like some sort of trigger that will bring it about. But to just suddenly stop sleeping, it's very rare.
Okay, hope that helps. A question here saying, can you please advise if boarding school syndrome has been officially recognized by the therapy profession? My research is ambiguous on the subject, but I'm convinced I have it and would like help. Dr. Tarai, this was a new one to you.
It was. I mean, I have heard of difficulties that happen with when children go to boarding school. But the boarding school syndrome, from what I've seen so far, is that it is recognized, but obviously it's not a disorder. But it is something that has been recognized to refer to the psychological difficulties and emotional difficulties that students might face from being sent to boarding school. Now, I think one of the most important factors is why they were sent to boarding school as well, because usually individuals who are sent to boarding school because either they don't have the proper education system in their country, or their parents want them to get better education, they don't usually suffer with the same kinds of difficulties as those that are, you know, sent away.
And I guess it's about communicating that as well, saying you are going to boarding school because X, Y, Z, and this is for your own good. And if that hasn't been adequately explained from the outset and that child feels like they are just being, you know, exiled and sent away, that could be very confusing.
Absolutely. Or, you know, sometimes what can happen is our parents, when they find children's behaviors to be very difficult and they don't know how to manage their behaviors, then they'll sort of send them away to a boarding school. And that can be very traumatizing for a child as well, almost feeling like I'm not good enough to spend time with my parents. My parents don't want to take the time to get to know me, to help me out. Instead, they're just, you know, wishing me away.
Now, my husband's not listening, so I can say this, but he went to boarding school and I've had to do quite a bit of work on him, let's just say. Lots of messages coming in on the topic of men's mental health, so do get in touch. We've got Dr. Thryer with us until 2 o'clock this afternoon. We've been talking about the kind of male role model and father figure. We've had a call on that earlier on. Message saying, do you think a strict father who worked a lot could have made me the way I am? I didn't see him much growing up, and now I don't know how to interact with my own children and sometimes even my wife, and I don't want to push them away.
Well, definitely therapeutic perspective, from a psychological perspective, and very psychodynamic as well. Childhood, any kind of trauma in childhood can really affect the way a person not only perceives themselves, but also relationships in their life. And their attachment figures are very important as well. And so for this individual, if they feel like they've never really attached to their father was very absent, not neglectful in the sense that they didn't care, but maybe not present in terms of really being emotionally there for the child.
Or demonstrative.
Yeah. Right. And what can happen is that especially men can take on that role when they become fathers themselves or husbands as well, because this is what they know. This is the pattern that continues. And one of the things that I work on with a lot of my clients is really starting to understand why their parents behaved in the way that they did, not so much to justify the behavior, but to understand it so that they can accept it and move on from it. And recognizing where, you know, you look at your father and you say, oh, he wasn't very present, he was very distant. I'm sure if you look at your grandfather, he probably did the same thing with your father, and then your father did that with you, and you obviously have recognized that you're doing that with your kids. So stopping that pattern, breaking that cycle is really important.
So acknowledging it really is the first step. Okay. This is a good question for you, Dr. Thry, because you do a lot of work with teenagers. A message had come in anonymous saying, my 18-year-old son has become very withdrawn. Even a few months ago, he was chatty, would talk about his day with me, but now he just wants to be in his room. Is this teenage behavior, and how can I get him to open up?
So usually regular teenage behavior of resisting parents that, ew, you're my parent, like leave me
resisting
alone.
Resisting parents.
You know that idea
that
you are so filled with cooties and germs that you cannot be around. You're such an embarrassment and a shame to your teenagers. Usually starts around 11, 12. For it to just spontaneously show up around 18 years old is not part of that natural teenage behavior, especially since before that, as she mentioned, the 18-year-old had been speaking to her previously. So that's not a normal shift. What I would suggest is to maybe find out what's happening with that child, because obviously something's happened to trigger this kind of behavioral change.
I mean, there could be all manner of things. It could be a relationship, it could be education.
Absolutely. It could be anything.
Friendship.
It could be social, it could be bullying, it could be, you know, he had a relationship and they split up and he's really sad and he's in his room. It could be, you know, that he's spending too much time on the computer, as she had mentioned. So it could be a number of things, but that communication is key, not just letting it go and chalking it up to teenage years, because really teenage years sort of shifts around 11, 12. And if your child is acting one way and then all of a sudden shifts that behavior well into those teenage years, then that's usually a completely different cause.
And second part of the question, how can I get him to open up? So any advice for speaking to teens and getting that conversation going? Easier said than done, I know.
So I think one of the most important things to remember about teens is the more that you push them, the more they resist. So you definitely don't want to try to make him do anything. What you want to try to do is just show him that you are always there for him. You will always be there to support him. Keep the lines of communication open. Ask him questions, and eventually they'll come around and they'll talk to you. But the more you push, the more they will resist.
Okay, wise words for anyone with teens out there. I'm going to read you anonymous text that has come in, and we'll address it after the break, but just to sit with it for a while. Anonymous message saying, I'm sitting in my car listening and I don't know how to speak to my wife about how I feel. I've always felt she needs me to be the strong one, but I'm cracking under the pressure of working, of earning money, supporting her and being a good dad. I can't spare the time to speak to a professional, but I don't know what will happen if I don't. Dr. Thuraya, we will come back to your advice. I'm joined this afternoon by Dr. Thuraya, who's a clinical psychologist and co-owner of the Human Relations Institute and Clinic, and she's guiding us through the topic of men's mental health this afternoon. I touched on a message we got in, and it can, of course, be completely anonymous if you prefer. And Dr. Thuraya would like to get your thoughts on this. A message came in saying, I'm sitting in my car listening, and I don't know how to speak to my wife about how I feel. I've always felt she needs me to be the strong one, but I'm cracking under the pressure of working, earning money, supporting her and being a good dad. I can't spare the time to speak to a professional, but I don't know what will happen if I don't.
You know, I think a lot of men have this need or have this impression that women need them to be strong, and they feel that women need them to be a certain way. But actually, sometimes men will realize that once they open up and they share how they feel with women, they're a lot more accommodating than they would expect in the beginning. And they don't expect them to be, you know, that they have it together all the time. And they don't expect them to be, strong all the time. That it's okay for you to break down with your wife. It's okay for you to say, I can't do this. I need your help. I need more. And really, communication between couples is by far the most important factor in maintaining not just proper mental health for both parties, but a proper relationship. So I would first say, don't assume that your wife needs you to be strong. First talk to her and see and feel how that works out. But in any case that, let's say you have spoken to her and she does say, you know, you need to be the tough one and you need this and you need that, it's also good for you to set that boundary, just like we were talking about before with Miriam and her friend. The idea that you need to set boundaries and say to your wife that, look, I can be strong, but I'm also human, and I need this support from you in these ways. You need to help me, and you need to do this because you are part of this marriage. And, you know, and it's okay for you to do that. It's okay for you to be a little bit assertive and say, I need help, and I need you to be my rock right now. I'm usually the rock, but I need you to be my rock right now.
And remember that your partners,
right,
in the true sense, and you support each other, and by opening up, it can only hopefully improve your relationship. And I'm sure it sounds like it's real fear of rejection there, of saying, I'm not the man you thought I was, but it has to be done. It sounds like he's really suffering there.
Oh, of course. I mean, men have this, like I said, I mentioned before, this impression that they need to be this type of person for a lot of women. But many women aren't looking for that. They're just looking for a partner, somebody to share their life with. And really, the more you share, you'll be surprised how a lot of women will be open and receptive and empathetic to your needs.
And what about speaking? He says he hasn't got time to speak to a professional, but what about seeking some kind of professional help?
I think that would be great as well. I mean, if you don't have the time, sometimes I say make time. If you have time to go out and hang out with your friends, if you have time to work extra hours, you have time to take care of your own mental health. Because if you don't, then later on the consequences of that will be much worse.
Okay. Now, the stats are alarming, to be honest. 12.5% of men in the UK are suffering from common mental health conditions, and over three quarters of suicides, 76%, are by men. And it's the single most common cause of death for men under 45. As we mentioned earlier, 84 men per week in the UK take their own lives. 84. Men are nearly three times as likely than women to become alcohol dependent or more likely to use and die from illegal drugs. Men are less likely to access psychological therapies than women. Now, I just want to play something for you. Zoe Ball is a well-known British radio and television personality, and her partner suffered from depression and died last year. She recently took part in this epic challenge to cycle over 550 kilometres in 5 days to highlight and support mental health projects across the UK. Have a listen to this as part of her journey.
I think the whole situation of what happened to Billy is quite unbelievable. There are times when I think where I can't really believe he's gone. I knew how much pain he was in. He couldn't make sense of what was happening to him. I could almost see, it's sort of like a change in the light. You could see the pain almost come into his eyes. You'd want to say, come on, stay with me. Let's find something positive, something joyous. Let's get you out of this headspace. And it was harder and harder to do that.
Two months ago, Zoe went to talk to someone who had suffered a similar loss. In 2012, Jamie Johnson took his own life when he was only 19.
We went out to Turkey and we were having a lovely holiday. There was, you know, Jamie was having a great time with his brothers. In fact, my husband and I did say to each other, it's like he's the happiest he's ever been.
I was going to say, did you have any idea? No idea at all.
Just didn't know it was coming. On the actual day, we were through 3 days into our holiday. I said to my brother, do you know where Jamie is? He said, oh, he's gone up to the room. I thought, oh, yeah, another afternoon sleeping it off. Anyway, we all spent the afternoon by the pool, really enjoying ourselves. And about four o'clock, my brother, who was sharing the room with Jamie, went up to get changed, take his son up to get changed. My nephew was with us. And he opened the door and found him. It was just pure shock and pure disbelief for a few months.
Tell me more about Jamie.
He made me laugh. He was bright. He was the life and soul of school, not always to his teacher's delight.
Yeah.
He just went from this happy-go-lucky lad into, I don't know, he was just sad. His self-esteem was nowhere at all. What does it matter? It was just like giving up.
Suicide is really cruel because you feel like there's so much you should have been able to do. How can this wonderful person get to a point where they would feel that everybody would be better off with them not here, or that they were a burden?
That was Zoe Ball talking as part of her journey looking into men taking their own lives after her partner did just that last year. Dr. Thryer, suicide rates in young men is on the rise, very sadly, of course. Do you think there could be a connection in the way that men and boys are socialised and the rising suicide rates?
Absolutely. I mean, realistically, when we talk about the suicide rates, the reason why they're three times as high. And, you know, you had given some stats about the UK, and even in the US, you know, it's one man every 20 minutes commits suicide. I mean, it's a scary thought when you really think about it. And it's because we socialize men to not speak, to not share, to not open up, and they have to be strong, and they have to be able to hold it together, and they should be able to you know, conceptualize their whole life and figure it out all by themselves. And that kind of pressure is quite intense, especially if you feel like you can't talk to anybody about it. And then men end up suppressing their feelings. You know, they put on this brave, smiling face, as we've all seen with individuals like, for instance, like Robin Williams. It's the same idea. You're smiling on the outside, but suffering on the inside. It's really depression in men. It does not show its form the same way it does for women. And that socialization, it really contributes to the prevalence of men committing suicide.
Message here saying, my father took his own life when I was 16. It makes me so sad to think that he went through terrible things and couldn't share them with anyone. And I think that's the cruelty, isn't it? If so sad, you know, you can't go back, you can't offer that shoulder. And often you don't know what people are going through at all. Message here saying, my brother has suffered from depression for 30 years. It took a long time for him to get the help he needs, and I don't think he'll ever be better. Thank you for talking about this. I want to ask you about postnatal depression in men, because it's something I'm seeing coming up more and more in the news. And obviously, we talk about postnatal depression or postnatal anxiety, even postnatal psychosis in women. But stats seem to be showing that men are suffering too. Can we talk about that?
Of course. So just the same way that women suffer from postnatal depression, so do men. But in a different way.
Because with women, obviously, it's a huge hormonal
right.
shift.
That's
a very gentle way of putting it. There's a... Yes. You're a train wreck, basically.
Right. Well, with men, they might suffer for different reasons, but they do suffer from postnatal depression as well. And actually, there's a great book called And Baby Makes Three by Dr. John Gottman. And he talks about how having a baby changes your life for both partners, not just the mother. And our tendency is to focus on women after, you know, she gives birth. But really, the man also goes through a lot of changes as well, because, you know, before he had a partner, now he has a partner who's focused more on a child. And, you know, now the intimacy is different. Now the relationship is different.
Her priorities might be different.
Her priorities are different. There's so many things that are different. Also, there's that sense of responsibility that the man has to think of as well. Because now it's not just, I'm taking care of another adult, which we are socialized to teach men, that you are the head of the family, you take care of the family. But also, now I'm responsible for this little helpless thing, and I have to make sure that it's safe, and I have to make sure that it's taken care of. And usually men of baby girls tend to suffer more than men of baby boys.
That's
because, again, we go back to that socialization that girls are more fragile and more vulnerable, whereas boys can take care of themselves. So it's really interesting to see how that works out, but for sure that men suffer with just as much postnatal depression as women do, but just in a different way.
And sleep deprivation, of course, doesn't help.
Mm-hmm.
Identity shift, I think, is a huge thing. And as you said, that kind of financial or perceived financial burden being put on your shoulders as the man and the perceived head of the household, no matter how much you're fighting against that, I think that's something a lot of men carry with them and struggle against. Dr. Thuraya is here. She is a clinical psychologist and the co-owner of the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. When we come back, we're answering more of your questions. Message that came in saying, hello, great program this afternoon, kudos to the Dubai Eye team. I'm a 35-year-old guy. As a long-time sufferer of depression and anxiety, I can relate to a lot of the situations being discussed today. Thank you for understanding the male aspect of it. Well, thank you very much for your message. A message that's come in asking for some advice, Dr. Thuraya, I'm just going to read this to you, saying, thank you for addressing our issues, finally. So divorced and a single dad to a 14-year-old daughter. Her mum is in the US. I had to send her to boarding school in Kuala Lumpur for financial reasons and for my daughter to have a stable life, as I'm working a lot. Her mum does not, and I had to stop all communication with her as she was too toxic in all that she said. Daughter comes here every 6 weeks for a week, but starting to become difficult to communicate. Any advice?
You know, first off, congratulations on trying to help your daughter in every way that you can, and even recognizing that sometimes when a relationship with mom is too toxic, cutting that tie is very important. I know for a lot of people it's very, very hard, and especially with a separation, sometimes parents go through this, what they call parent alienation, where one parent talks negatively about the other parent trying to separate, but that doesn't seem to be what's happening here. However, if you find that your 14-year-old, remember she's a teenager, so at this point she will start to distance herself from you, if it's still difficult to talk to her and to communicate with her, my suggestion would be to just always show her that you're there no matter what, that you keep trying, that you're not giving up on trying to communicate with her. Usually teenagers will separate from parents initially, but as they become, they get to the ages of 18, 19, 20, they start to realize that, you know, my dad's always been there, for instance. And she will realize, she'll say, my dad's always been there. He's always tried his best. You know, we didn't have the easiest of situations, but he was always trying. And she will appreciate that as time passes.
Okay, I hope that helps. A message saying, hi, thank you for your nice advice. I want to get your view on the book Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. Have you read it, Dr. Thryer?
I have. I mean, there are a lot of great things about the book, to be quite honest, but there are some things I think that might have been a little bit too reductionist in the way that they explain things about men and women. But it is a great book in terms of recognizing how we communicate differently and how we receive information differently. And maybe really just highlighting that if you're a man talking to a woman, you can't talk to her like you would one of your buddies. You have to
no.
You have to change. The same way for a woman. When you're talking to a man, you can't talk to your man the way that you would talk to one of your female buddies. So that we have to adjust our communication style because the reception of our communication is very different depending on who we're talking to.
We had your colleague Chastity on the show on Valentine's Day talking about the five languages of love,
mm-hmm.
which was a book given to me during my marriage preparation course, believe it or not. And it's still something that my husband literally this morning was like, okay, when I get home, I'm going to do this in the girls' room. And I was like, oh, his language of love is doing stuff. And I'd really just want to hug goodbye this morning. But I think that is also quite a useful book in terms of understanding how you communicate love and how you receive love, and the same for your partner.
Mm-hmm.
If we're talking book recommendations. A message that's come in on the issue of socialization of suppressed feelings for men. How would a man overcome that? It's been programmed into our system now, so trying to access and analyze those feelings is impossible because we've been suppressing so long. I personally struggle to understand the feelings, let alone know how to talk about them.
So that's a great message because it really shows the consequences of the way that we socialize men in general. What I would, I mean, ultimately you have to focus on yourself right now. We can't solve the world and we can't really focus on how to change the socialization. But learning about your feelings, really becoming more mindful. I mean, there are a lot of different ways, not just through therapy, but also mindfulness techniques, recognizing what's happening in your body, recognizing and putting a label to it, and therefore then understanding where it comes from, why is it there, and eventually getting to a point where you can actually discuss it with someone. And don't be shy too. I know that there's a big group of individuals that feel that if I talk to my buddies about it, they're going to laugh at me. But actually, what I see is that, you know, slowly men are becoming a lot more mindful, sometimes a lot more than women, and they're becoming more empathic as well. And so you'll be surprised how many of your male friends will connect with you, and they start to hear that actually it's not just me that I'm going through this. And when they start to feel like there's more of us that go through this, that support system will be very, very beneficial.
Yeah, so showing some vulnerability might
absolutely
will benefit you in some shape or form. I think the word mindfulness, we hear it so much now, and really what we're talking about there is recognizing those feelings. And there are so many distractions. It's so easy to think, oh, I'm feeling a bit sad, I'm going to pick up my phone and just distract myself with Instagram, or go to the fridge, or go to the bar, or, you know, seek out something to distract us rather than sitting with those feelings.
Yeah. And I tell my clients this all the time, because they always, like, you know, when I feel sad, I go and I watch like my favorite Netflix video. And I say, no, Don't. When you feel sad, feel sad. Because the only way to get through something is, I mean, or to get over something is to go through it. And you have to feel those feelings. You have to understand where they come from. You have to, it's okay to suffer. We have this idea that we should all be happy all the time. And that pressure is ridiculous because we're not supposed to be happy all the time. We're human, which means we have an array of emotions that we must experience in order to understand how to become resilient, how to overcome them, and how to get through them. So it's okay to sometimes just be present with your feelings and go through them.
Any advice on resources for anybody listening who wants to read a little bit more about men's mental health or seek some more support, Dr. Soraya?
So there are a few resources around the world, actually. In the UK, there's something called Mankind and Safeline as well. They are purely for men and mental health. In Canada, there's Heads Up Guys, and you can go online with these as well, so it's not just for those that live in these areas. And there's also I know a couple of Instagrammers that are really good at promoting men's mental health. There's an individual, a handle, that's the word I was looking for, I'm very not tech savvy, but his handle is I've Got Your Back Bro, and he's also out of Canada, and he really talks about men's mental health. And there's another gentleman here who's actually a fitness person, I think it's called Warrior Life, also talks about men's mental health. That's his Instagram handle. So there are a lot of people that are talking about men's mental health, and really, if I had to say something to the men that are in Dubai, I would have to say you're not alone, and there are so many men that are feeling the same thing, and you're not vulnerable, you're not weak. There's nothing wrong with you if you're experiencing these emotions. If anything, it makes you just as human as the rest of us.
Dr. Soraya, clinical psychologist and co-owner of the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. Thank you for sharing your thoughts, your wisdom, your advice this afternoon. Really looking forward to having you back on the show. Thank you for everyone who messaged and called in. We really appreciate your bravery on the topic of men's mental health. Also, thank you to producer Joe, Marcus in the booth over there.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcast at DubaiEye1038.com.